Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we begin today with the eternal reality that war is hell. The first headline in the War on Terror this week was Iraq declares victory in Mosul. ISIS is ousted from its Iraqi capital. But the subsequent headlines have been anything but triumphant. Today's New York Times video shows Mosul civilians trapped in a fight clearly not over. Time magazine, heavy fighting shakes Mosul a day after victory is declared. The New York Post, the heartbreaking aftermath of the Mosul victory, not to mention Mosul victory risks sectarian violence from the Arab News, and from Foreign Policy magazine, Iran claims victory in Mosul. With me now is Foreign Policy magazine senior reporter covering the U.S. Defense Department and national security issues, Paul McCleary. Among many other things, he has done embedded reporting with Marine Corps units in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll also talk about the reported Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner proposal for privatizing the war in Afghanistan using a company owned by a major Trump donor, Eric Prince, founder of the Blackwater private security firm. He's also the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Prince was also reported to be setting up a Trump and Putin back channel this year because somehow everything seems to come back to Russia. Anyway, Foreign Policy magazine senior reporter covering the U.S. Defense Department and national security issues, Paul McCleary, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Good morning.
Can I start on privatizing the war in Afghanistan? The New York Times broke that story, which included the proposal, anyway, for replacing U.S. troops in Afghanistan with private mercenaries, but also included Defense Secretary Mattis rejecting the idea. From what you can tell, is privatizing the war in Afghanistan alive or dead?
It's still very much alive. It seems that Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner have warmed to the idea somewhat. And, you know, it's known that Eric Prince, as you said, has been a contributor to the Trump campaign, and he also has regular meetings at the White House with White House officials. But Secretary Mattis, I mean, this isn't the road that he wants to take. They would lose, the Pentagon would lose some control over the how they conduct the war and how they conduct the training of Afghan troops, et cetera, if they would use private security contractors. As we saw when there was a large footprint of Blackwater and DynCorp security contractors during the heaviest fighting a few years back, they're subject to different rules. Not always. I mean, there are, many instances where they did the job professionally and well, but there are also many instances where, they shot up convoys, they broke the law, et cetera. I mean, they're not under the same command and control structure as U.S. forces. So the Pentagon isn't interested in sending a mercenary army to Afghanistan to replace U.S. troops.
The idea of a private army replacing the 10,000 or so U.S. troops is alarming to many people. I think you just gave us one or two of the reasons. Should it be as a knee-jerk reaction? In your view, are there both pros as well as cons to privatizing a war like a war in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, it would really be uncharted territory for something this large. I mean, if you wanted to send, there are 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan now, and with the proposal that the Pentagon has given the White House for anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 more, if you're talking 10,000 private security forces operating in a foreign country, not all of these private security forces would be American citizens. So, what laws are they subject to? They wouldn't be under the Uniform Code of Military Justice that U.S. troops are, that, imposes pretty harsh penalties for misconduct. So it would be a vastly different operation than anything the United States has or any Western nation really has ever undertaken.
One way or another, I've read that Mattis is supposed to present Trump with a plan for Afghanistan sometime this month. It's America's longest war ever at 16 years, as many of our listeners know, and shows no sign of ending. Do you expect a victory plan from Mattis or more of a permanent war management plan?
Well, this is, I mean, they've been in the management stage for a while now in Afghanistan. I mean, this plan was supposed to have been presented to President Trump in mid-May before he left for the NATO meeting in Brussels. That's what all the Pentagon officials were saying. They said they had it locked up. They were going to brief the president. Vice President Pence had been briefed on it. And then it never went any further. And then I think some of the factions of the White House were unhappy with the troop plus up in Afghanistan with no end in sight. So it's been bouncing back and forth between the Pentagon and the White House since then of what they wanted. Now, they're saying mid-July. There's some rumblings. Now they're pushing it back possibly to late July, whatever that might mean. But the plan isn't done, and they're going back and forth. And I think what Secretary Mattis and the Pentagon want to do here is make the U.S. presence in Afghanistan look a little bit more like what we are doing in Iraq and in Syria, which is push U.S. troops a little bit further or push them off the bases, embed them with local Afghan units to help at the tactical level, calling in airstrikes, advising on specific fights, which they already have some ability to do, but most U.S. troops are on bases training and advising Afghan military leadership and in the ministries, and they want to get these guys out, not to fight necessarily. They'll have the right to self-defense, but in order to advise at the tactical level.
Why don't we just get out? Doesn't terrorism against Americans come from recruiting on the internet now, not gathering plotters in Afghan caves like Osama bin Laden did 20 years ago?
Well, part of what they want to do, and I think part of the discussion here, is widening the scope of the strategy from just Afghanistan to Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Afghan Taliban takes their leadership is in Pakistan. The Haqqani network moves back and forth over the border. So I think they want to try to, as much as possible, secure the border in some respects, but also bring the Pakistanis in to a larger kind of peace and reconciliation process. And I believe they think in order to do this, first you need to defeat the Taliban or inflict as much pain as possible on them to bring them to a negotiating table so Kabul can negotiate from a position of strength. So that's what they're going for right now, to try to roll back a lot of these Taliban gains in the north and especially the south in Helmand province, where they're pushing on Lashkargah, and they've retaken many of the places like Marja that the U.S. Marines fought so hard for. Just a few years ago.
But why is that our job in 2017? From a Trump nationalist America First perspective, I would think he might say, well, we've been fighting there in support of the Afghan people as well as to protect Americans against terrorism that might come from there for 16 years now. The terrorist threat is not essentially Afghanistan-based when it comes to risks to Americans. This is not our fight anymore, whether the Taliban or somebody else controls Afghanistan. Why wouldn't that be their position from a Trump America First standpoint?
I believe in many ways it is their position. And the Pentagon counters that despite their best efforts, I mean, there are, I think, 17 to 20 distinct terrorist groups in Afghanistan operating now. ISIS has moved in. So now they are using that as the reason why we need more troops in order to try to ensure that Afghanistan isn't a vast lawless area where terrorists can plot, which actually large portions of the East already are. But they want to try to contain that as much as possible, if that's possible.
My guest is Foreign Policy Magazine senior reporter covering the U.S. Defense Department and national security issues, Paul McCleary. And listeners, should the U.S. privatize the war in Afghanistan? What do you want to know about the Bannon, Kushner, Eric Prince axis? Should Jared Kushner even have security clearance for this kind of leadership role after he failed to disclose at least three meetings with Russians on his security clearance form, we now know, including the one in which he was presented explicitly by Donald Trump Jr. with that email describing Russian government interest in helping his father-in-law get elected? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. You can talk about Iraq as well with Paul McCleary from Foreign Policy, 212-433-9692. Little more on Eric Prince. I mentioned that he is Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's brother. But he's been a major figure in U.S. policy much longer than she has. He just never needed Senate confirmation for the role his company, Blackwater, played in the Iraq War under President Bush. Remind us, why was Blackwater and the privatization of a little bit of that war by the U.S., why did that become such a controversial thing among Iraqis?
Mostly, I mean, what Blackwater was doing, they were guarding U.S. VIPs. I mean, they're guarding U.S. generals. They're guarding State Department officials, USAID officials, when members of Congress would go over. Like I said earlier, you know, they pride themselves on that. They never lost anyone that they're guarding in Iraq. But in order to do that, I mean, there's books written about this that, if cars came too close, they would put a couple bullets in the front grill. They would put bullets into windshields. They ended up killing a lot of civilians in the name of protecting the principles that they were guarding. And I mean, some people in the U.S. military were wary about riding in convoys too close to Blackwater convoys because they're unpredictable and they didn't know if they would act professionally or if they would turn their weapons on whatever car came close to them and open up.
I know Jeremy Scahill, now with The Intercept, wrote a book about Blackwater. Eric Prince himself wrote a book promoting his accomplishments and the idea of private armies. I also read that Eric Prince is considered an alt-right figure close to Steve Bannon, and that he has suggested in a Wall Street Journal op-ed just recently that an American be put in charge of governing Afghanistan, like General MacArthur oversaw Japan after World War II. And people have said Prince wants that job himself. Then I guess he'd be Prince. But that doesn't seem like Trump-style nationalism either, with no nation building abroad. So why are the Bannon and Jared Kushners interested in him?
I think because he's providing them an option in a situation in Afghanistan where, as we've seen over the past 16 years, there really are no good options. And other than the tried and true tactic of adding more troops or, you know, increasing bombing runs, increasing, you know, UAV sorties, he and Mr. Feinberg, the DynCorp financier, another security contractor, are giving them an option that also relies on the private sector, which Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner and some folks in the White House are very interested in privatizing as much government function as possible. So this would provide another avenue for the privatization and letting business handle an issue that, in their view, the U.S. military has been unable to handle.
And he reportedly was setting up a back channel in the Seychelles in January between Trump and Putin. Why would heads of state like the presidents of the U.S. and Russia even need a back channel brokered by somebody like Eric Prince?
That's a great question. I mean, I believe that it would be an attempt to keep it out of the, you know, the day books and keep it off of the official schedules of some of the intermediaries for the two leaders. And try to do things a little differently. I mean, I think the Trump campaign prided itself on doing things in a non-traditional way during the campaign. And they are trying to do this in as far as international diplomacy as well. And this would be, you know, another way to kind of shake things up and do things differently and see if they can get a better result.
Speaking of Russia, the Donald Trump Jr. emails about accepting Russian government help to smear Hillary Clinton seem to have taken that story to a whole new place. The Trumps have spent the last 8 months denying collusion. The new line is collusion is normal. All candidates do it or would do it, take opposition research from a hostile government. But as a national security reporter, do you have any reason to believe that Jared Kushner will lose his security clearance for failing to disclose this meeting and at least two others with top Russians? It's becoming amazing that he even has the power to develop something like the Afghanistan war privatization plan with Eric Prince after he covered those things up.
Yeah, well, I mean, the White House has been very hesitant to comment on who has a security clearance. We're working at the West Wing and Sebastian Gorka.
You mean we don't know if Jared Kushner still has security clearance?
We don't. They won't comment on it. Sebastian Gorka, another White House counterterrorism official, does not have a security clearance, most likely. But the White House won't comment. And just yesterday, the White House spokesperson said that they won't comment on whether Jared Kushner has or does not have a security clearance or has lost it.
Huh, that's intriguing. Do you know who decides on security clearance? Who says revoke or maintain to Jared Kushner, who isn't related to him?
Well, I mean, the intelligence agencies and the CIA vet these people and give them their clearances in the first place. But I think it would have to come from the executive in order to make the final decision, even if it was recommended to revoke those clearances. I mean,
the executive means the president.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not any big secret who has clearances and does. I mean, if you look on LinkedIn of government officials, people will link what level clearance they have. This isn't a national level secret. It's just they're refusing to confirm or deny who has or doesn't have clearances and or who may or may not have lost them.
It's not a matter of public record?
It is not, but they can make it public themselves. But they don't have to disclose it.
But it's voluntary. So if somebody like Sebastian Gorka, who does not have security clearance, can be an important foreign policy advisor anyway, does security clearance even matter for what Jared Kushner can do tomorrow or next year?
It does. I mean, there's meetings that Gorka cannot sit in on. He cannot receive briefings from the CIA or the other intelligence agencies that are secret level briefings. This doesn't mean someone else couldn't tell him what went on in those meetings, but there are things that officially he's locked out of.
Lori on the Upper East Side, you're on WNYC with Paul McCleary, who covers the Defense Department and national security issues for Foreign Policy Magazine. Hi, Lori.
Thank you. I just don't understand what privatizing means. I mean, who do they answer to, and do they get paid to do this? I just don't understand it.
Well, it's like any other contractor, right? Except it's not because it's war, but it's structurally like any other contractor. Would that be right to say the pay comes from tax dollars, but instead of employing public employees, in this case, members of the U.S. military, to do the fighting themselves, they hire a firm who hires private individuals who are employed by them to do the fighting in the war, in the theater of war. And that's what it is, basically, yes?
Yes. I mean, the U.S. government will contract out to DynCorp or Blackwater or Triple Canopy or any one of these other companies to go through and vet and hire folks who work on, logistics or maintenance or doing training for foreign forces. We have contractors, military contractors, working all over the world doing police training and things like that in the name of the United States government and the State Department. And that's what would happen here. We're essentially, the idea is to pull U.S. soldiers out and put vetted and one would assume trained private citizens in charge of carrying out these tasks.
Is there reason to believe on the part of those who advocate this that it would be more effective somehow, that these private employees would be more effective than U.S. troops, or that the managers, I guess you'd call them, would be more effective as leaders than American generals and admirals and so forth?
I think it would be less expensive in many ways, most
less,
likely.
Less expensive.
Yeah, it costs a lot of money to equip and train and maintain U.S. force presence overseas on these bases. And then there's health insurance costs. If they get hurt, there's lifetime health insurance. So things like that. Private contractors don't get that. If there's many cases where Blackwater or DynCorp employees have been hurt or killed in Iraq or Afghanistan, and their families don't receive the kind of, lifetime benefits from the U.S. government that a U.S. service member would.
Julian Hastings, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Brian.
Go
Thanks
ahead.
For taking my call.
Sure. What do you want to say?
Oh, sure. Sorry. I just thought it was interesting that all of your segments today on Mosul, on deregulation, on climate change.
I see you've looked at the list of what's coming up later in the show.
Exactly. correctly, that many of your listeners would know, but maybe some would not, that one of the biggest lobbyists on the progressive side of all of these issues, Middle East deregulation problems, climate change, one of the biggest lobbyists in Washington is the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And so I just wanted to put that on the radar screen.
You're just kind of promoting the virtue of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops as being progressive on social...
And actually, they often don't trumpet this. Pope Francis does much more.
Yes.
But the fact remains that if you look at official Catholic teaching, the majority of it is on the progressive side of the issues, and today's segments are a case in point.
Thank you very much. Zach in the Hudson Valley, you're on WNYC. Hi, Zach.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I just two basic comments. I mean, the first one is obviously the legacy of what happened by Eric Prince's company in Fallujah is such a stain on the American conduct in Iraq, and I think repeating something like that would be just a huge disaster, especially when using terms like hearts and minds, which is such a common thing in in the press these days. But the other thing is the question of the logic of capitalism and its need for expansion. I mean, if you privatize something as critical as war, then clearly the need to make a profit off of that, to sell shares of stock to shareholders, means that there's always going to be another opportunity to make more and more money. Where's the next war going to be? How are they going to profiteer off of these things? And, what are the limits? I think it's just completely immoral.
Zach, thank you very much. To his point, Paul, generals, I think we see in recent years, are actually sometimes more reluctant than hawkish politicians to go to war. They know the upsides and the downsides. They don't want to lose their troops. They see the risks and potential, failures of war, where anything can happen and where they probably can do fairly accurate threat assessments. Remember how generals were seeing what could go wrong in Iraq more than the defense secretary Rumsfeld, who was a civilian, and all kinds of things like that. If war was being waged by a private company that stood to profit from the war, then it actually makes the quote-unquote military a lobbyist with a vested interest in expanding military conflict. That's what Zach is pointing out. I just put it another way. But that's a really threatening thing, it seems to me.
Well, I think, once you start the process of privatizing warfare or even, combat training and things like that, even though contractors do already do a lot of training, but once you do it on such a large scale, that changes the game and it changes the calculus. And also brings in unknowns. I mean, if you just simply replace all U.S. troops with contractors, I mean, what kind of air support would they receive when they came under fire? What rules would they operate under? There'd be so many things that would have to be worked through and understood and would fundamentally change the way the Pentagon and the State Department operate in those areas. So it would be, like I said, it would be uncharted territory, and there would be a lot of legal wrangling, I believe, in order to even define the terms of how this would work.
Brian in Sussex County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi. My question is kind of to that point that you were just making there. Say we drop a bomb or a drone, we do a drone strike and we take out civilians, I believe anyway, I might be mistaken, that we as the United States, are legally responsible for if we get taken to court for, okay, that was against the Geneva Convention, yada, yada. So what happens if it's dark water? Like, do we, are we responsible for if they do something awful? Or I just was wondering how that, you know, how that shakes out.
Right. Who would be legally responsible for a war crime in a privatized army situation? Do you know? Is it clear?
Well, that's one of the issues. I mean, there was the one famous case in Iraq and in Baghdad where Blackwater killed over a dozen civilians. And then the company was taken to court by the family members and sued. And the U.S. government, I mean, wouldn't be – they would hand liability over to the companies in this respect.
They could do that?
Yeah, they have. I mean, Blackwater was sued by many civilians in Iraq.
But wasn't that one of the reasons that the Obama administration got completely out of Iraq in 2011 instead of leaving some residual American troops there because Iraq wouldn't agree to indemnify American soldiers from lawsuits in Iraq, which is the standard practice, not to let troops be, and those are troops, not private army members, but I think the question is essentially the same. The U.S. government wants U.S. troops stationed on foreign soil to not be liable for damages or to be held criminally responsible for things they do in other countries in the line of their duty as soldiers, and Iraq wouldn't agree to that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's called the Status of Forces Agreement, the SOFA, which we had in Iraq previous to that, and then the Bush administration negotiated that, negotiated with the government in Baghdad, and the government in Baghdad wouldn't extend it past 2011. And the Obama administration tried to continue that, but, you know, they kind of gave up and said, well, okay, then we'll just pull our troops out if we can't have the Status of Forces Agreement.
Do we have it now? Do we have it back now that Trump has put troops and even Obama put troops back into Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an agreement now between the United States and Baghdad that U.S. forces would not be can't be arrested by Iraqi forces and prosecuted there for any alleged crimes.
We have a few minutes left with Paul McCleary, senior reporter covering the Defense Department and national security issues for Foreign Policy magazine. Mosul. The Iraqi government has declared victory there over the Islamic State. For people not following the war closely, why is Mosul significant to ISIS and to the United States?
Well, Mosul was a major cash generator for ISIS, if nothing else. I mean, it was a city of hundreds of thousands of people that they levied taxes upon to fill their coffers. You know, they raided the museums. They conducted some commerce there, and they also planned. It was where al-Baghdadi declared the caliphate in July 2014, and they would plan overseas operations for Mosul. So taking that away from them was a huge blow to the concept of the caliphate, and it was a major operational center, recruiting center, and cash generator. I mean, ISIS isn't going away. I mean, they're still in Tal Afar in northern Iraq. They're still in Hawija. There's still a few cities where there's going to be a tough fight. And General Stephen Townsend, who heads U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria just earlier this week, said he expects ISIS to go underground in Iraq and that the fight isn't going to be over anytime soon. They're going to go back to their terrorist roots, their insurgent roots, rather. And, you know, suicide bombings in Baghdad and Kirkuk and other cities.
If we think of victory over the enemy as an occasion for roses and parades, the AP wrote this week, after 8 months of urban warfare, the Iraqi armed forces declared victory over the Islamic State. But at what cost? The city of Mosul was left in ruins. Thousands of civilians have been killed, and almost a million have been displaced, adding to the already massive refugee crisis in the region. What's your understanding of the humanitarian situation?
It's pretty dire. I mean, it's obviously the middle of summer right now, and people continue to pour out of western Mosul. Hungry, traumatized civilians by the thousands. And the UN and the Iraqi government are doing everything they can to try to get these people into camps with tents and food and water. But there are instances where they're running into some of these Shiite militias, you know, Mosul being mostly Sunni city, Shia militias who have rounded up some men and boys and taken them away.
Is that why Foreign Policy has a headline, Iran declares victory in Mosul?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of these Iranian-backed Shiite militias across that have deployed across northern Iraq, and it's part of that road that the Shia crescent that Iran wants from Iran through northern Iraq through Syria and into Lebanon, of mostly Shia people, and they can keep the supply to both Damascus and to Hezbollah going as long as they keep those routes open.
So that's the imperfect choice the U.S. faces there. To defeat ISIS, we have to empower Iran.
Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi from in Baghdad unlike Prime Minister Maliki before him, I don't think he's as close to the Iranians, but the Iranians are a major partner for Iran. They're a neighbor, obviously. They're both majority Shiite countries. So, the Iranians will benefit in some way from the taking of Mosul, I imagine. And there's probably not a lot the United States can do about it, either diplomatically or militarily.
When Trump and Putin met last week, they agreed to a ceasefire in part of Syria. I've read that it's in a part of Syria controlled by Assad, so it's really a win for him and Russia without much benefit for the United States or for defeating ISIS. Do you see it that way?
So it's a win for Assad for sure. I mean, it takes some pressure off south of Damascus, where he was fighting some of these rebel groups. And it's not an area where the United States was really operating at all anyway. It was mostly Hezbollah forces down there, some government forces, a lot of Iranian-backed militias. But with this ceasefire between these militias and pro-government forces and the rebels there would allow Assad to move some of these forces east into Deir ez-Zor province, where there's still a Syrian base and which Assad wants back. It's kind of along the Euphrates Valley between Iraq and Raqqa. There's been movements of Iranian-backed militias there and a lot of Russian airstrikes in Deir ez-Zor, and that's where a lot of the ISIS leadership has gone. So it will relieve some pressure there for him. But the ceasefire, as far as the Pentagon's concerned, I mean, folks I've talked to there didn't really have much information on this before this deal was undertaken, and they're trying to figure out exactly what the ceasefire means, if they will work with Russian, military officers to try to enforce it, if the U.S. planes will fly over this area. So it's a ceasefire in name, and I believe that the fighting has lessened, but the American involvement is still an open question.
So does the United States get anything from this, or are critics right to call it a Trump giveaway to Putin at their meeting last week?
I think the United States, what they would get is, if you're the Trump administration, you have fewer compunctions than others about working with the Russians in Syria to try to pacify the country. So the Russians get international recognition of working with the United States on this issue. The United States gets not a whole lot out of it. It wasn't really an area we were working in or concerned about a whole lot. The United States is really focused on ISIS, whereas Russia, this takes some pressure off them too, because they're fighting ISIS a little bit, but they're mostly fighting these rebel groups, some U.S.-backed groups that are fighting Assad.
Foreign Policy Magazine senior reporter covering the U.S. Defense Department and national security issues, Paul McCleary. Really informative. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you very much.